Hello, hello.
Welcome back from your meal. Hopefully that was pretty good. Did you enjoy your sandwich?
I did indeed.
Yes, did I. Delicious chocolate cookie I had. Some potent vinegar chips. Well, welcome back. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm Jerry and I'm here with Darren. This is module 4, second day. This would be module 11, I believe. 7 plus 4 still. 11.
I think it still is.
We'll be talking about view services today and or in this module. And we've got a lot of view services inside Solarizer. Those are what we're going to be kind of pouring through. But before we talk about anything, let's talk about what a view service actually is.
So, at least to us.
At least to us. That's right. Oop. That's right. And I think it's worth saying that sometimes it's referred to as a view service.
Mm-hmm.
People call it different things in different places.
Some people might just call it a service. Others, helpers.
Right. Right. So let's define it. Let's define it officially. Not officially, but let's define it in writing.
Yes. It's in black and white, therefore it must be true.
This is an encapsulation of code and an abstraction of code so that it can be reused. We are sending it as injections to our view models, but we're also sending it as injections to our services. Mm-hmm. It could have been used for unit tests, but we have not written any of those.
Indeed.
Yes.
Bad us.
It happens. All right, so that's what a view service is. It's just a wrapper of code, right? All right, so let's look specifically. That's the generic view service. Let's talk about what the Solarizer services are. This is really going to be a code review module.
Yep, we're going to be diving in.
A lot of the things these services accomplish don't have a visual.
Exactly, it's a nice thing.
So there's a handful of, there are tons of services inside the solution. And you might be asking yourself, I wonder if I could ever get the solution. And the answer is yes. We'll put it up at xaml.codeplex.com a little later from now. If you're watching the recorded version of this, it will certainly be up there for you. But nonetheless, it'll be there soon. That's where all this is. We're happy to give it to you. And hopefully you'll be able to use at least the helpers behind them, if not the services themselves. So we'll be talking specifically about a few. We've already covered several. We talked about the primary and secondary tiles and the toast service already. But now we'll be talking about the dispatcher service and as well as the keyboard service. We don't actually use the keyboard service inside Silverlight.
Blah, blah, blah.
I don't think we do use it in Silverlight. We also don't use it inside Solarizer. But I had to include it anyway because it's a really
great
service.
Some very cool things.
The launch time service, the location service, the manifest service, the share contract service, the web API service, and the way we do settings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Settings as then internal values that our app uses, not something that we surface up in a UI to users.
That's not settings fly out, not settings
contract.
Contract.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just settings internal. You could say it's constants. You know, there's lots of times you could do it that way as well. There's a lot of approaches we'll talk about when we get there. Help me keep on track, will you? I'm gonna switch over to Visual Studio,
sure.
And you just make sure I don't miss any that are there. All right.
Or wander too far from the path.
Or wander too far from the path. Exactly. Let's see. Here is the Universal app. I'm just gonna do a quick build to make sure everything's still happy.
Of course, you changed your list of services and haven't shared it with me.
Is that true?
It's true.
This isn't it. Oh, because I have web API and settings.
Yeah, I got it.
There we are. Ah, good. Everything builds and works just fine. All right. Have I been monkeying with the setting, the services?
I believe
prior to this? Yes, I have been. Because why not? What are you going to do over lunch if not code? What's a keyboard for if not crumbs? So true. Words to live by. All right. Walking through just quickly the shared project, one of the things we'll talk about in the next session are some of the behaviors that we're using. These are visual declarative extensions that we use inside Blend. We'll talk about those later, but I just want you to know they're there. Inside our common folder, we have several extensions that, Darren, you wrote a few of them. I wrote a few of them, and they do some handy things that kind of make the APIs do what we want, including you wrote a pretty cool one that is the observable collection.addRange.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't exist in the actual API for observable collection. does now, pretty great. I'll show this real quick. It seems like absolute cheating, but we put it in namespace system, which is an overload of the existing base system. That seems really crappy, and I guess in a sort of way it is. But more than, oops, that seems really tricky, but in a sort of way, I guess it is. The what happens is you can't use an extension method inside C# unless you are using that namespace up in the using statement, you actually mention it. System shows up all the time, so it's a great place to put it, in my mind. Right? There's no rule that says you shouldn't.
No, there isn't.
There's no rule that says you shouldn't. There's some other stuff here we've kind of gone through already, but I wanted to point that out before we moved on. We have a handful of converters I'll show off. These are converters that we used. You'll write your own, but all of these, again, come with the Solarizer name, Solarizer code base that we'll be giving you. So if you're like, whoa, I'd really like to have some of those converters they're probably using. Well, there they are, and when you see them, they're not quite as magical as you probably think. They're usually just one quick line, but it's the way converters work. As a quick shout out to performance issues, converters definitely are a cause of performance problems when they're overused.
Yeah, especially if you're using a lot of converters within every item in a long list, then that is a lot of overhead you're introducing into your rendering.
The Boolean to converter, the Boolean to visibility converter is called Boolean to visibility convertery. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the converters list.
At least it's converter-ish.
Converter-esque.
Is that a word?
It is. It's totally a word.
Yeah, it is now.
All right, so let's run on down and go straight to the services folder inside Visual Studio and start at the top and kind of move down. We talked already about the ADOL service. That's the Active Directory
Authentication
library.
Yeah.
This is a wrapper that we wrote. We certainly did it interface-based so we could pass it around, but it's really more of a wrapper than a specific service. But then we talked about the blob service, and this is the blob service. This is the helper, has all the logic in it, and of course we abstracted it up for the service that's reused throughout the application, the specific code for it. But that's the blob service, not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk first about the dialog service, which has to be the most common. I mean, it seems like every application starts by building a dialog service.
Of course, you immediately start on one that wasn't on your list.
Oh, well, I'll go to dispatcher service next then. First, let me just say, the dialog service, what's special about the dialog service is, this is the one that we used in all of our demos so far. When I was showing about messaging, we always use the dialog service. And being able to show a message is easy enough, right? All we use is the regular message dialog, and we call show. We do or don't make it asynchronous or with a task so you can await it. That's totally up to you and how you implement your dialog service. This is how we did ours, but one thing we did for sure was we created a Boolean here that tracks whether or not there's currently an open message dialog. Because this is the only way we show dialogs, this is a reliable marker. And the reason is the message dialog can only be open once. If you try and open another, you get an error.
Yeah, you actually get an exception raised up in the application, which is unpleasant.
Yeah, and it's not unreasonable that you would try to show to. This just queues it up and shows the next one as soon as the previous one is closed. Right? So it sort of saves you a little bit of pain, and the helper kind of adds some value for you there. Anyway, let's start with the dispatcher service. The dispatcher service is important because what do we use the dispatcher for? Now, for what do we use the dispatcher, Darren?
So basically the way that the UI has been implemented in Windows pretty much from the outset is there is this context of a single UI thread that is responsible for updating the presentation. The idea is that only elements that are actually executing on the UI thread are allowed to interact with that presentation layer. Now, because we're in this brave new age where we have these systems that are capable of doing multiple things at the same time, and we have all these infrastructures that allow us to leverage different threads for interacting with services across the web and so on and so forth, there ends up the scenario where you can have activities being performed on one thread that suddenly wants to update the UI. That could be, for example, the return from a web service that's been dispatched out to a background thread. It may be updating a binding, and indirectly, that binding is bound to something in the presentation layer, so it's trying to update a service, or it's updating a control. The dispatcher is used to allow us to identify whether we're actually currently running on the UI thread, and if we aren't, to actually request that an action be performed on a UI thread?
Yeah, so right here in this method called safe action, the first thing it does is it says to the dispatcher, am I on the current UI thread? Because if it is, then there's nothing special you have to do. You just execute. But it's a matter of thread. It's not thread safety, but security between the threads that doesn't allow something off the UI to write or to update the UI. And so if it does already have thread access, UI thread access is what this really means, it goes ahead and executes whatever operation was going to happen. If not, then it queues it up and it runs it on the dispatcher, and the dispatcher itself executes it inside its context. So this is what the helper does, pretty simplistic. The only thing that we need to do is pass in the dispatcher when it's originally created. That's important. We have to do it while we still have thread access. And in that case, we use app.xaml.cs because the executions inside our main app XAML are on the UI thread.
The main reason for doing this is it's actually difficult in the view model to get hold of the dispatcher for the current window. That's ultimately what the challenge is. In some of the other XAML frameworks, there were easy shortcuts that would allow you to say dispatcher.current, and then you would be able to get hold of that and interact that with from the view model. This allows us to encapsulate that behavior and save it for later use.
That's right. So here we are inside onInitialize async inside AppXAML. We inside the Unity container, we're registering an instance. The type is this iDispatcher service that already create. That's what we created, right? Because this is our dispatcher service. And so we're registering just the instance because we want to capture the reference to the UI thread that we have right now. And so we create a brand new service right here instead of allowing it to create it later. And then we pass in, because this is a requirement that we've made inside the constructor, to pass in the window.current.dispatcher. Window.current.dispatcher is impossible to call and get the correct dispatcher outside of the UI thread context. So this does that. Now from that point forward, we can pass the dispatcher to anything that needs to do a UI update. And a common UI update that fails is a simple property change notification being raised. And so that property change notification being raised might need to be run inside the dispatcher using that very clever safe action, right? So all you pass in is a delegate. There's a lot of dispatcher helpers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This is very simplistic.
Yep.
Yep. Just does one quick thing. It's quite nice. You know what I might add as I'm looking at it is you might actually check that as it's being constructed, you make sure that it has thread safe or it has the UI thread already.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You could be passing in the dispatcher that's it'll end up being null when you try and use it.
Yep.
It's a fun idea. All right. What's the next one after? Is it keyboard next?
I believe it is.
Okay. Good. 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 All right, so the keyboard is especially nice. If you are inside the Windows runtime and you're trying to capture keystrokes, what an endless problem this is. If you're trying to capture keystrokes, the way that you do it, and let me pull this up real quick, is by using the core window.dispatcher accelerator key activated. That's the event that's raised whenever somebody touches a key, right? Now, these accelerator keys aren't just special keys, they're also just standard keys, but whenever that event is raised, here's the handler for it. Whenever that, remember, we're inside the helper right here, not the service. And so whenever this is raised, the core dispatcher accelerator key activated is raised, passing in a set of arguments, but what you really get back when it all boils down to it is the virtual key. And so virtual key is enumeration, and if I were to jump to the definition of virtual key, so you could see, is it enumeration or is it enumerable? It's an enumeration.
It's enumeration.
Dang it.
You get back an enumerable.
It's an enum.
It's just something you can enumerate through.
It is an enumerable. Dang it. It is an enumeration.
It's enumeration, yeah. Enumerable is something that can be enumerated.
That's right. All right. You're right. That's right. It's an enumerable that can be enumerated. No, I got it backwards.
Just carry on.
I'm going to call it an enum.
It's a thing. It's a thing with strings and numbers on it.
Why is this so difficult for me?
Yeah.
I blame the chips. All right. So anyway, we've got this virtual key enum, and you can see they all line down everything you could possibly press. And sometimes keys that don't even exist on your keyboard. Right?
Yep.
No doubt about it. But what is unfortunate about the way that this is implemented is that there is no immediate translation between the key that's being pressed and the actual letter that you want, right? Is this uppercase? Is it lowercase? It's really difficult. And wait, maybe what you want to do is wait for the uppercase zero and the lowercase I, or all these different things that you might want. It's really a pain. So along comes the keyboard helper. The keyboard helper listens for those keys and then has this clever little, let's see if I can find it here. Here it is. You got this clever little converter here, .2char, that returns the character itself that you have, uppercase or lowercase, whichever one is actually correct, so you can do a test against that, and if you're listening for the event. So really, this is really intended to just help the English keyboard, because if you look at it, these are only the English keyboard letters and numbers. If you want to extend this to be localized in other languages, obviously you need to consider that. And but this will get you started and show you how to do it, at least initially. And so let's see, the keyboard service itself, I only care about one thing, and that's a chord of keys. So in this case, I want to know when the chord Control E occurs. And so Control E is really valuable because that's the universal gesture to begin a search. If you went into Outlook or if you went into OneNote and you did a quick Control E, it would take you directly to the search dialog, didn't it? It does, totally does. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of people know that. So you might include the search box, let's say, and if you include the search box in your Windows application, you're gonna want to support Control E and give focus to that control as soon as it occurs. Anyway, it's just one of those things, and that is the keyboard service, and we don't use it inside, we don't have search, and we don't use it inside Solarizer. I'll show in our next session, however, we use it inside, not the service, but we do use the same sort of logic in one of the behaviors that we use to allow for navigation, but I'll talk about that in the next one. All right, so the next is launch time. And so let me start by going over to our app.cs and show you how the launch time service is really used. So launch time is right there. All right, so this is the launch time service is used. And why is it used right here inside the initializer? On initialize async, because what we use this for is to determine the time between the last launch of this application and the current launch of this application, and whether or not the session state should be cleared. So remember, a lot of the information that you put into forms and different pieces, if they're decorated properly, Prism will automatically roll those up into a saved state so that the next time the application launches, it'll restore all that for you. The problem is, a long time could have passed between when they launched the app last, it was suspended and terminated, and now when they're launching the app again, and it's absolutely incorrect to restore the state. It's just been too long. Yeah. And
sense. They've lost their context. They won't remember where they are.
That's right. Or there's no universal reason or time frame that you can use here, but sometimes what they might be working on may have even expired. Right?
Yeah. You're looking at an app that's showing, say, the Bing News Feed or the MSN News Feed now, as it may well be called.
Yeah.
You want to save your place in the article. Perhaps it's the first article, the header article for today, but tomorrow it's a new news article.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make much sense to save your position where you were on that.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yet you may go away for an hour and coming back is reasonable. So for you, clearing the launch date isn't about a number of days that have passed, it's about a number of times, number of hours that have passed. Sure, absolutely right. So let's jump to the interface and see what that's like. This is the interface for launch. This is the implementation for launch time, actually. But it has only one property. Is that a property? Yes, that's a property. Whether or not, in this case, now look, this is specifically built for Solarizer. You need maybe. Is that all right? Barry's eyes are going bad. All right, I'm gonna make everything just a hair bigger. How about that? Now I should be able to drop to 100 without too much pain. Good. Anyway, it has a single property here, and that property is calculating how many days, for us it's days, the number of days that have passed since the last time it was executed. So if we were to look at the helper class that does the implementation, right, like that, there we go, right? It keeps the, as soon as it occurs, it keeps the current date, allows that date to be stored up into settings, then it pulls it out, parses that date back into a real type, calculates the date difference between them, and then returns that to the, and returns that to whoever's using it. In this case, it's going to be the service. The service does all the logic of actually determining how much time has passed. And one interesting thing here is that how it determines not how much time has passed, but whether or not that's too much time, is because we put that in settings. And so here is an example of a service that is injected somewhere, but the service has its own injection, right? It has its own dependency that it having come in. In this case, we have an interface for all of our settings that we can pass around, and that's the way that works. So pretty cool. We can have interfaces that are injected into our view models, but we can also have them into our services. Yep. So that's what launch time is. It's actually quite simple, but it gets the job done, that's for sure.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about these where you've got all of these dependencies, unless you're actually creating an instance at the time you're putting it into the container, you can put these in any order, and the container will evaluate the nested dependencies and instantiate those dependencies in the correct order so that the requested type is always created correctly.
That's right.
Now, obviously, if you create a codependency where you have one item that depends on something else, which depends back on that item, then it can't resolve that, and you'll get an exception thrown at that point.
Yeah, because those circular references, it couldn't resolve it. Neither could you if you were doing it manually.
Yep.
You could. I just mean the average person. All right, so that's what the launch time service, really useful. This is an MSDN recommendation to make sure that when you are resuming, that you don't resume your state if too much time has passed. They never show you how to do it, so here's one implementation.
Mm-hmm.
All right, is the next one location?
It is indeed.
All right, so
you're
location.
You're in great location.
Very excellent. Let me start with the interface. So using the location service built inside Windows, uses the location API. A couple of neat things about the location API is that you don't have to have a GPS in order to use it. It can use it based on your Wi-Fi, based on your IP address, and all of these things fall back.
Or your radio if you're on the phone.
Your radio if you're on the phone, or your GPS if you happen to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And, it triangulates, that's right.
Yep.
And all of these things are, one is more reliable than the next, and so on.
Or more accurate.
And it goes and uses the most accurate one that you can use and you actually have. So if you don't have anything, my desktop at my home, I'll tell you, this is crazy. This is terrifying is what it is. My desktop at my home, of course, doesn't have a GPS. Doesn't have anything, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And it knows my address. I mean, it's not my lat long, but my address. It's terrifying. Anyway, so we have this location service available for any Windows runtime application. And so if you elect to use it, we do use location. Yeah, we use location in order to get direction. No, we pass that off.
Oh, we pass it off. We
let the map do that. I think we initially put this in here because we thought we were going to.
And we can talk about that in terms of power in a moment.
And negative influence on a power.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. So the way the API works is you ask for a position, and from that point forward, it raises an event that tells you when the position changed, and you can ask for it again when the position changes. And so this service just wraps up all that logic and allows you to ask for whatever the position is. It's always kept up to date, and so it's just a way of asking for it in a non-asynchronous way. You always have to ask
for it. It's kind of like preemptive. You know, you can pull when you need it, as opposed to relying upon something to push to you and responding to that.
That's right. If I needed to disable positioning or something like that, I could do it all in a central location now because I've put it all inside a service.
Mm-hmm.
The helper itself is just using the location API. Nothing really serious going on there. We use the geolocator, which is the base part of the API. We read the initial position, and then we set up a position change to return what that value is. The service itself, which uses it as a helper, all that it does is returns whatever the helper's position is at the time. The way we've written it, there's no way to turn off the location service. The reality is we don't turn it on, so it's not a big deal to us. But if I were to leave this on no matter what, there are some implications.
Yeah, it's going to be constantly leveraging the location service. Obviously on your desktop, unless you know, you're too worried about you're being environmentally friendly and not burning any more power than you need to. It's not going to dramatically impact your experience on the system. However, if you're running on a mobile device, the phone is going to be constantly leveraging the location service, and it is going to negatively impact your battery power and so on. So you might choose to do things differently. It's one of the reasons, in reality, why we chose in Solarizer to delegate location and directions to an external application only when the user invokes, you know, give me directions.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I don't think we actually demonstrated how cool it was clicking on the directions in Solarizer.
Oh, remember you clicked it and then you went to install it and it was installing Windows Phone, remember that?
I wonder if
Windows Phone ever installed.
Yeah, that reminds me, I should install that map so we could at least show it because it's a pretty cool experience.
Yeah.
But that nonetheless.
If you were going to do it, what I would probably do in a full implementation would be perhaps to use a timer so that I check what the position is based on a certain amount of time. That way I don't constantly ask for it. But having said that, it's a pretty reliable service that does a good job of caching and handling when all the requests are. You can also extend so that you're only asking for, you're waiting for it to give you a position. But remember we were talking about the tiers, right? You could get it using a GPS, or you could also get it using triangulation. You could get it also using nearby hotspots and your IP address. You can specify just how large of a radius you're able to tolerate, because the reality is, let's say you're a weather application, you really don't need to know which house they're at. You only need to know what zip code or maybe even what city that they're in. So you can ask for the least expensive way of getting the location of the user as well. That helps with battery life. It also helps with performance, because some of these low-hitting or easy larger radius zones are easy to determine really quickly. Finding the exact house that a user is at, not only is it expensive from a processing and battery point of view, but it's also just a hair slower. And it's the reason all of these APIs are asynchronous, to be honest. Cool. All right, so that's the location API. Now let's open up the manifest API. Manifest service. So this is the manifest service that we built. And we built it for a couple of reasons, but let me first explain the concept of what it does. Here we are. So this is the service itself. I need to know when I go into, what's the manifest, by the way? Let me go up into Windows and look at the Apex manifest right here. The Apex manifest allows me to set up all kinds of things specific to store applications. So one of the things that I can set inside Visual Assets is to go ahead and set up the, right here in splash screen, set up which image is going to be for the splash screen. You can see we've done it and we've scaled it as well as what the background is that I want. So in this case, it's black, but it might be navy blue or whatever is right for your application. And this is my specific splash screen. We call it splash screen PNG, but it doesn't have to be. It could be named absolutely anything. So think about that as we talk about the manifest service. So how would I make a page that would use the splash screen? I want to use this image, and I want to allow the developer to come in, make changes to the splash screen, and not worry about keeping everything up to date that wonders which PNG it's supposed to be, or make some tweaks to the background color without going through the entire application and making sure there's some sort of hard-coded reference to it. The way we do it is through the manifest service. The manifest service, the helper does all the work for us. The manifest service opens up the actual Apex manifest XML file and begins to parse it. Now, it doesn't parse everything. It certainly does parse a lot, but it doesn't parse everything. And our service only cares about two of them. We parse quite a bit more than just two of them, but it goes through it. And as a warning, and you can kind of see this with these conditional pound ifs, the way that the manifest is built inside Windows Phone is slightly different than the way the manifest is built inside Windows. So just know that this it certainly isn't brittle, but it is definitely volatile in the idea of which head you're going to use it. If you're deciding you're going to write your own and not use ours as a base, just know you're going to need to really check some things around namespaces to make sure that you account for the subtle differences between the two Apex manifests. Anyway, it goes through, reads them all, puts them in a nice tightly typed class so that you can access them really easily. It's not just a dictionary of strings and all the other mess that kind of makes it difficult to use. So then inside the service, remember we only had two properties. That was for the splash image and for the splash background color. That way the helper handles all the casting, so when I get it back, it's not just a string. It's an actual color from the color enum that the Windows runtime gives us, and the splash is the string or the URL that we need or the URI that we need to go get that image. So pretty handy right there, and I could pull other things from the manifest as well. I could pull logo information, or there's a lot of things as well as checking to make sure that the capabilities are there. One of the things I thought we might use this for, but then it became more overhead than it was really worth, was the ability to pass the manifest to other services such as location, and location double checking that it was enabled in the manifest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a little more than we needed, but we still used it here. Where do we use the splash image, by the way? We use it in the splash page. So if I were to go to the shared views folder and show you the splash page, it actually opens up and it's completely blank. The reason it's blank is because it all needs to be dynamic at launch time. But if you look at the code behind, here, there's no view model, by the way, for a splash screen. That's not the way that this works. All we have to do is, because it's not, this isn't the extended splash screen.
Exactly, and it's running before your application proper has been initialized and so on, and it's allowing you to do things like configure your container for dependency injection and all these other things that could be long running.
And it happens long before the container is ever created, so I'm not able to do dependency injection into it. And if you look at the code just right here inside the constructor, what it does is it sets up right here the image that's in XAML to make sure it matches whatever that splash screen is. Because remember, the splash screen really is just the image that's centered when the application is launching. That could be just about any size. And there's a recommended size, and then there's a scaled size, so it can change depending on the platform that you're in. So we make sure that its height and width are set explicitly, that it's top and center the way that you would want it. And then if anything changes, which would change because the user snaps the application to the left or right or changes the orientation, all of that gets fixed again because we have the size changed event wired here. Anyway, this is just how the splash screen works. We've talked about this in previous MVAs and how we haven't changed the code hardly at all. But you'll see here we changed the color using the manifest service, and we changed the image using the manifest service as well to make sure everything is correct. Mm-hmm. And that's where we use the manifest service. If you wish that you could read the manifest to do something in your application, here's a starter of how to do it. By the way, the extended splash screen is set up right here in the constructor specific to the Windows application. And I mistakenly hit F5.
Ah, good job.
Turns out, hey, the app runs.
Hey.
That's great. All right, no problem at all. All right, so here's the partial constructor specific to Windows, and here's where we set up the extended splash screen factory. That's how we build it. And you'll see we don't use injection. Instead, we are passing in actual instances of things because we're way early in the pipeline. That's what the manifest service is. Let's take a look at the next one. What is the next one, by the way?
Share contract service.
Share contract service. The share contract was introduced to us in Windows 8, right? This is the way there was meant to be a single point of invocation for common actions inside the operating system. Basically, you'd swipe from the right and get to charms, and you would go into settings. Or you'd swipe from the right and get to charms, and you would go into share, right? Depends on what it is.
Yeah.
So the share contract also exists on phone now, as of Windows Phone 8.1 when our team, we can leverage that.
I'm really
that.
Chuckling at this one.
What's that?
If you look at the implementation.
Of a share contract?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't planning on showing it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so this is standard. This is right out of the box. Such a dork.
Runs as coded.
As coded, that's right. Well, there's not much to do in this share right now, to be honest.
Yeah.
But eventually, we were going to implement a whole sharing thing, right?
Yeah.
But we didn't.
And that's another session.
Yeah, this was just a placeholder for what we were eventually going to do. But I would like this to show the UI. It'd be neat for people to say invoke sharing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get around to writing it. That's exactly right. I'm going to just move on now.
Yeah.
What I wanted to show, I can show it better probably in settings contracts service here, is that you're going to have to handle the reality that even though the show UI for the share contract is going to be universal between Windows and phone, sometimes you're doing something like the settings contract, which is not universal, and you're going to have to do something more like this, where you implement the show UI, but when it comes to phone, if they try and use the same API, you give them a friendly reminder that it's not implemented on that platform. Right? It just kind of goes on and on from there. And if you don't do it this way, by the way, for the show UI, if you don't do it using a service, then you require that your view model now have access to all those namespaces. And if you start to abstract your solution away so that you're moving things into, let's say, PCLs for testing, that PCL now needs to have a lot of references you may not actually want to give it.
Right? Sounds like a plan.
Sounds like a plan indeed. All right, what's the next one?
The next one is the Web API service.
Ah, Web API service. So we've kind of already demonstrated the Web API service in that we demonstrated the Get Async. That was just a cut and paste directly from ours. So if you look at the Web API helper, the Web API helper is completely generic, right? You could use this in any application. It doesn't understand the ADAL service or anything like that. It allows you to do get, it allows you to do put, it allows you to do just get and put, right? So we didn't use, there's a couple others, get, put, delete, and post. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, so we didn't implement those because we didn't need those, but eventually we would to make a full service right here. But if you look at, or a full helper, but if you look at the service implementation, the service has then an additional reliance on the iADAL service, or the ADAL service, and passing in the auth header, which of course we talked about where you wrapped it inside the ADAL service. And so you use that, you append it to the HTTP client, but that's all done in the helper.
Yeah, I would actually like to talk a little bit about the put async implementation that's in the Web API service. So if you want to cut over to me, Barry. Okay, so this is the Fuller service, and one of the things that kind of tripped me up a little bit, to be honest, was everyone shows GET, because GET is a really easy scenario to demonstrate using the HTTP client. Very rarely are people actually showing the other methods, the other verbs that we can use on these REST-based services. And it turns out there's a little bit of extra work that you need to do if you want to do a put. And so we have that encapsulated within here. But let's just quickly kind of run through and refresh ourselves exactly what we're doing. So the idea is in this service, we create a wrapped HTTP client. And all we mean by that is we take a regular HTTP client. Let me zoom in a little bit so people can see a bit easier. So we take a regular HTTP client, we turn around and say, hey, we're expecting to get back results in a JSON format.
Right.
And this is where, as Jerry mentioned before, we extended out our ADAL service to inject an auth header. If we actually quickly leap out to there, whoa, I
awesome.
Forget about this.
Using CodePeak.
Yeah, hey, who put that in there?
It probably took you right to it.
No, it took me. This is what I wanted to show. So as part of our authentication result that we get back from ADAL, not the ADAL service, there is a method that will create an authorization header. Now, all this does is it actually creates or takes the token and prefixes it with a string, which is bearer in lowercase, followed by a space. That converts this into the format for a JWT, JSON Web Token format, which is what you supply as the value to this authorization header value. So that's what happens there, and we just cache that so we can send that across.
The method you're using is actually part of the SDK.
ADAL SDK, correct. So I just wanted to quickly call that one out. Anyway, let's get back on track. So getting the async values is pretty simple and straightforward. We create a response based upon our URI. We check to see if our status is okay. If it is, then we're going to carry on and process our response as JSON and convert it to a string. If it's not okay, then we throw out a Web API exception. Mm-hmm. This is us determining how we're going to handle this. We actually let these things propagate up into the calling method, which determines based upon what type of exception we've got here, whether we're going to turn around and say, okay, we didn't find the appointment, that's okay, we can deal with that, or goodness gracious me, the service is completely gone. We need to turn around and stop the application and because we're in a state that we can't recover from.
Web API exception is a local custom exception that we created.
Correct.
Yep.
And those are really easy to create. It's as simple as deriving from an exception, and we drop in a status code. That's our extension to that.
Simple as that.
Okay, so that's pretty simple on the get side of the house. On the put side of the house, though, we have this concept where we have a destination URI, and we also want to deposit a payload at that URI. So this is the scenario where we're actually trying to update an existing appointment that's out in the web. So just a quick run through the sort of REST-based verbs. The idea is with a get is basically a retrieve. You have a delete verb, which is pretty self-explanatory in terms of that is going to delete the object to which we're referring via the REST protocol.
Right.
We have a post Now, the idea of a post is it maps to an insert operation.
That's right.
So put, as an HTTP verb, maps to an update of an existing object. Yeah. So that's basically what we're doing
here. I'm
really
glad you said all four of them, because this is a web API concept in a lot of ways, right?
Indeed.
And they're like, well, I wonder which is which. And by the way, calling delete, calling put, calling get, calling any of them is just an instruction to web API
it's
on
semantics.
What it's supposed to do. It doesn't actually cause it to happen.
Yes, it all depends on how you implement it. Depending on what frameworks you use, for example, if you're using OData, and the services that are automatically generated as part of OData, then that's a convention that it absolutely adheres to.
Yeah.
If you're building your own services, you can do whatever you like. I would strongly recommend we actually follow a pattern of practice, however. So anyway, coming back to this, we're invoking this with a URI to our web service with a payload, which happens to be the appointment that we wish to update. So we get our wrapped client, so we have our headers and so on already set. First thing we're going to do is we're going to get hold of our appointment and serialize it. This is using JSON.NET to serialize this into a string. Then here's the gotcha that oftentimes isn't explained particularly well, which is we need to specify the media type that we're going to use when we upload this. Mm-hmm. So we're actually saying the element that we're sending to you is going to be in JSON format.
I see.
So that's the first thing that we do.
This is almost the opposite of setting the default request header to accept JSON.
Correct.
This is saying we're sending you JSON.
Exactly. Then the next part, let's bring that down so we can see this in the screen. The next part is telling us to await for the response for a put to this URI, and then we actually tell it we're sending you HTTP string content.
Mm-hmm.
That's the data, and we're actually going to encode that in UTF-8 to ensure that we don't have any characters or whatever that isn't going to come across. And this tells our web API implementation how to deal with the string when it's arrived. If we don't do that, you get some strange errors that says unknown media encoding sent across or unable to serialize it and so on. So this is to make sure that we're actually able to send data via the put verb to a web API. Okay? And
I'm glad you walked through that, because there's a lot of gotchas that are easy to get past once you know how.
Exactly. And so that's why I called that out. Sorry to derail the chat. By all means, carry on.
Well, I'll be able to get over it eventually.
I know. You're such a sensitive soul.
All right. Let's take a look at the settings service that we have. So the settings service is something else that we can pass around from object to object. If you look at it, the way it's defined inside here, the interface, these are all the different things that we need in order to get our application to work. It's sort of like a constants file might be, but we use it as a service, and let's talk about kind of why that might be a good idea and why that might be useful for you. So see, we have the web API base here, the Bing key. We have the days, that's what we used for the launch time.
Is that Bing key or Bing key?
That's a Bing map key.
Okay. You got a little Bing
the
key
the hub name. I mean, just everything we're going to need. There it is. And if you go down to the implementation, we do it very simply, right? All we do is just jam those in as literals. This is probably a terrible idea rather than a good idea, but certainly it's the way I would say most applications would start here, right? At least while you're developing. Then where do you actually get these values? Some of them would definitely come from the configuration inside your application. So if you look at the web API base, this is the URI up to our service. You know, you can't go to a service and ask for the service URI. That doesn't really make sense. You have to have that first.
Mm-hmm.
Chicken and the egg sort of thing. So what we do is instead we have this hard-coded, but maybe inside your application, everything else then comes from the service.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to go and initialize the settings. Settings then calls out to the service, gets all the settings, and then as you ask for more settings, they're all fresh from whatever was inside.
And this would be another scenario in which perhaps you store the API address and a version of the settings that you have. And then you could check on startup, okay, I got V1 of settings. Are there any new settings? No, there's not. Okay, I'll use my cache values and
that's
so
right.
on.
If you end up putting this in the actual settings API, that's no problem, right? This can pull that out as well. If you need to decrypt a setting because you're not going to store it as plain text, that's fine. This can be all the logic that handles doing all of that for you. And so mm-hmm. it's a nice thing to have a code base here so that you can manipulate your settings any way you need to. We made it as simple as possible so that we didn't have to. But probably if we were moving forward, we definitely would take some of these, like my map key here, the blog key, and I would take all of those, move those up into something that's a little bit more reliable. Don't fool yourself. Unfortunately,
you're not always going to be connected.
Anything inside a map, anything that's in memory can be sniffed, right? That doesn't make it secure, but it certainly helps in the security of it all. But that's true too. We need defensive programming around connections. Perfect. I think that's the last one we were going to talk about as far as services. It sure was. Hey, you want to have a demo of services?
No.
we've got some quick talking points, and let's just power through those. The dispatcher service provides that that link back to the UI thread. The keyboard service provides translated keystrokes. Pretty valuable right there. The launch time service tracks the time between launches so that you can expire your cache. The location service provides a simplified way of using an asynchronous API so that you can get the position, and also a unified way. The manifest service allows you to read that Apex manifest XML file. The share contract service provides a simple way to interact with that service. And then settings, which we just saw, gives you a way to have a strongly typed way of accessing items in that you might otherwise put in like a configuration file or up on your service. So remember this one thing about Vue services, they just don't need to implement every feature to get the job done, right? Because the reality is these APIs are very, very broad. You might write a helper that is really exhaustive, but the service you need is specific to your application. There it is. Now, one of the things we used, if you can remember the front page of our application, the first thing was really an interactive map. And so that was exciting when we thought about putting that on there. It was going to be nice and fun. Turned out it was a little bit more work than we expected mm-hmm. because there are two types of maps.
Absolutely. So let's kind of talk about that a little bit. So what you have with the phone is the phone has this mapping capability that's kind of built into it. It's pretty awesome. And we also have the Bing Maps and the Microsoft Maps technology. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, as Jerry mentioned, they've been built independently. And they don't have the same API surface. They don't take the same type of coordinate. Mm. So in terms of wanting to create a universal app, there's no single way to interact with the map. What we did was we were kind of looking at that going, oh, shoot, we really want to have this interactive capability. How are we best going to do that? And I started to research into, okay, what's the ideal way to approach this? And what I found was there's actually an article out on MSDN where somebody actually demonstrated using poundIF to separate these things out into a number of different methods. So because we knew that strategically we wanted to demonstrate some of these different techniques for creating shared code, this seemed like an ideal candidate to bring into the project and actually talk about in greater detail. So I believe we've already demonstrated these things, but here is the simulation, and it's running around. This is actually these images were actually being generated by another service that we did jump over, which was the map service.
Ah, yeah, that was in the service list.
Yeah, so in the services list, we actually have the ability to integrate into the Bing Maps API, which allows you to generate offline maps. So basically, we can pass up to this map service the location that we want. We can also add in on the query string that we want to create a push pin at a specific location. We can say what zoom factor we want, what size of bitmap we wish it to render, and so on. So we actually do this when we create the appointments and put them into our database.
So that's a static image.
That's a static image, yes. You know, I can't move around with it. If I click on it, it would actually navigate to the appointment itself. This, however, is an interactive map control. And I can zoom around on here, zoom in, zoom out. As I start up the application, this actually launches and zooms into the appointments that are being listed over here, so we actually see this. And there's actually a different implementation on the phone. Quick navigation. So if I flick over to the appointments, you'll see that this will automatically zoom in. This same effect has occurred over here. Mm-hmm. One has it built into the mapping API, The other, we actually have to do a bunch of code manually to work out where this is and to run this animation and bring it off. We also see that we have these different zoom factors, and that's based on differences on the border around the containing area. So let's kind of have a little look and see how this is actually realized within the map control. Controls, map view. So here we go. So this is, in effect, a lookless control. It derives from grid rather than anything else. Mm-hmm. And that's basically because we want something that's going to appear in a rectangular or square shape and is going to be sized to what contains it. And that this gives us a nice basic behavior. And straight away, we start seeing some of this pound if funky goodness. And if we kind of zoom out for a minute, you can see that there's a lot of pound ifs.
If you look at this and you feel like, oh my gosh, there is so much code. How am I ever going to figure this out in this talk? Don't worry.
Don't worry.
Another one of those controls that we've rolled into Solarizer. You can take it, plunder it, go from there. And at the top, I've noticed, you gave a little link so you could get to the original article.
So basically, this explains in a lot more depth some of these aspects and how to view it. So feel free to read that offline. So anyway, some of the key things around this were related to the startup, the design experience, how we can render these things. For example, the Windows version of the map control is available during the design time experience. Mm. The phone version is actually not. It won't render up at all. Mm. And it turns around and says, this control is not available during design time. Pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. We also have different ways of applying settings and setting up various layers. So for example, in the phone, or the Windows rather, map layer, we have map shape layers, different layers, and the ability to build these and add these to the map. On the phone, we don't. We just have a single layer where we can do whatever we want in terms of inserting XAML controls. So there's a lot of differences in the way that these behave. Because we wanted to have this consistent single control that we just drop onto our XAML, so if I look at the views main page.
This is for Windows, not for phone.
This is for Windows. I can quickly zip down.
There it is.
And here is the map control. This looks identical to the way it's actually used in the phone head. Of course, it's on a different pivot item. So here's the appointments, and here's the map view. Exactly.
So it does
the same
feel
values.
Like a universal control this way.
It feels like a universal control. We've been able to simulate that common experience by leveraging the pound ifs and having this in the shared project.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you think they're going to unify the map so there's only one map control when it all comes together?
It feels like you would expect it to happen.
Yeah, no doubt. When you see what's happening in Windows 10, then you really
see. You see that it would happen. For example, we chose to use a single type of data type to represent a location. On the Windows app, it actually uses, I think, basic geo-coordinate, whereas on the Windows phone, it uses geo-point. Mm-hmm. So this is an example of an extension method that will resolve those, and I believe we put that in the deck. So let me just show this quickly.
Great.
So here we have the code that talks about GeoPoint. Oh, clicking on code doesn't work in the PowerPoint somehow. So we have the GeoPoint, which has been returned back directly by the phone, but we're calling an extension method that actually maps these things. So if we look over here, here's examples of some extension methods. Some of them take a location and creates a new geopoint, which can only be constructed from a basic geo position, and then passes in the location, latitude, and longitude. Mm-hmm. This one will take a geopoint directly, and this one will take a basic geopoint directly.
Nice.
But using extension methods can give you a nice, consistent way of returning these and allowing us to use this.
So now, your code up, feels better, you can isolate your code as well.
Exactly, and we can obviously do the two-way conversion here, where we take a geopoint, convert it to a location so we can put it into the map center.
Again, we've taken all of his code, rolled it into Solarizer. You'll be able to get it when we post it up on saml.codeplex.com. This, all the services that we have, and everything we've talked about for the last 2 days as well. Here's a takeaway point I think is really worth thinking about. When part of the framework is not converged, right? That's just a reality that we're in today. Don't panic. We can abstract this away and resolve it. The map control is really a great way of seeing how we can have these separated pieces that don't work together at all, but we can give them a unified feel now by bringing them together with a little bit of coding. There's a reason work is called work sometimes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't get frustrated by the fact that you may be moving ahead of some of the other APIs and so on and so forth that are out there. That doesn't diminish the opportunity you have in the store. You know, it's we're seeing a lot of people turning around saying, well, should we even bother looking at universal apps because Windows 10 is just around the corner? Well, Windows 10 is going to launch in 2015 at some point in time. I don't know when. Certainly other people probably know when. But the reality is there's a lot of time left this year. There's a lot of time during the early part of next year where your application absolutely can corner the market and generate a lot of revenue or a lot of interest and so on. Time is always going to move on. The platform is always going to continue to evolve. Technology is always going to march on. Take advantage of the tooling that's available right now. If you take good architectural approaches to building these things and abstract those areas that you know are likely to change, you know, heck, are we likely to have a common map control we can use in the future? Almost certainly. But we could choose, it's going to be too hard to solve the problem today, and I'm not going to put in a map control because I have to work out how to use two. Or it's a great feature for my users, therefore I'm going to solve that technical challenge and put it in there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, let's look at what we just did. We just went through all the services that we needed, and so we implemented those inside Solarizer and kind of stepped through those, just like you will inside your application. You're going to need to use some sort of API that's in the runtime, and you're going to want to wrap that up in maybe a helper that simplifies the API, but certainly in a service that simplifies the API specific to the implementation you're doing. That allows you to have that so you can pass it around and inject that into your view models, maybe even inject that into other services that need it as well. And as soon as you encapsulate all that, it makes it nice, bite-sized pieces, little Lego pieces that you can start building out your application. Really, really nice. We also talked about the approach for maps, and the reality is that some things just aren't fully converged, but here's an approach that makes it really easy. You're going to come across perhaps one, two other things like that as well. There's a solution to all of those because, hey, we're all computer scientists here. We're all computer engineers. We know what we're doing, and we can build out solutions for those as well. That's the end of this module. We've kind of gone through Solarizer. Remember all the code we're giving to you up at xaml.codeplex.com, and
Advanced Services is next.
And Advanced Services is next when there's more that we'll be covering. And we'll see you in just about 10 minutes. Don't forget, there's going to be a Q&A in the last session. In that last session, we're going to we'll talk about everything you guys want to ask here. We have a lot of little tiny things we haven't talked about yet as well. And I guess if you have any questions on Windows 10, we'll answer all those as well. See you in 10 minutes.